I've got Descartes' letters right here.
I had them on in either hand, and I felt like I'm a gunslinger.
Like you were jewel wielding.
I'm a gunslinger showing up to the battle.
I got to get something. I forgot. I want to quote metaphysics just to make Aristotle sound stupid.
He's running away, Colin.
He is. He can't take the heat.
Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Camel. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Davenant Press and the senior editor of Ad Fontes, and I'm joined as always by my two co-hosts, Colin Redimer, vice president of the Davenant Institute, and Rhys Laverty, associate editor at the Davenant Press. Gentlemen, it's good to be here with you.
Hello.
Good morning.
All right, well today we are going to be talking about the soul. Basically, the way that this podcast is set up is that Rhys is the guy who knows the Bible, and Colin and I just sort of bicker about philosophy. But since the Bible has a lot to say about the soul, we're going to kick it off to Rhys to get
Does
us
it?
Going, to tell Does us it? What we should think, and then we'll take it from there. So, Rhys, the soul, what do you have to tell us?
Well, I mean, Colin's asked the key question. At the very start, does the Bible have anything to say about the soul, or what we tend to call the soul? And just before we were recording, Ansi and I were just debating whether or not the Bible is coherent as a whole about what we now tend to call the soul. So just to kind of survey the data, and then, you know, I'll try and keep Ansi and Colin honest on this as we go through. And in our Easter episode, we didn't mention Jesus for like 20 minutes. Now that's not entirely true.
We did spend a lot of time talking about not Jesus,
about Oedipus.
But we got to rectify that. That
woe unto me that I sojourn in Athens. That was that episode. But so just to give an overview, you know, because you would think, oh, the Bible, that talks all about the soul and saving the soul and the immortality of the soul. But the biblical data is a bit more diverse and confusing than that. So in the Old Testament, a word that we would often have translated as soul. So our brain might go to something like Psalm 103, you know, praise the Lord, O my soul. And that word there for soul in the Hebrew is nephesh. It's used about 700 times in the Old Testament, but it has a lot of uses, and it's used quite a few times, to be honest, before it's even translated as soul. So in Genesis 1, when you have the living creatures, so Genesis 1:20, they are the word for creatures there is nephesh, rooted in the word to breathe. So Genesis 2, when God breathes life and man becomes a living nephesh, a living creature, a living soul. That word for breathe is the same root word. It's the word for life in the blood in Genesis 9. Sometimes it's just translated as people, in the same way that we might mean like kind of number people as souls, like when a boat sinks, we, for some reason, we tend to say how many souls went down with the boat. Just as life, it can be to do with your being willing. So in Genesis 23, Abraham says to the Hittites, if you're willing, if your sort of nephesh is in it, it could be to do with the throat. Some people think it's got a root there, but the Bible Project say that, but it's not as black and white as they say with that. It's there in the Shema, praising God with your soul in Deuteronomy 6. It does then start later in Genesis to kind of get used in the way we might think. So when Rachel dies in Genesis 34, her soul is said to be leaving because she is dying. Her nephesh is leaving. Then it can just be used as sort of an ambiguous word for people. So in Leviticus, if anyone sins, when those things happen, it's if a nephesh sins. It randomly, surprisingly, it's used of kind of dead people at different points. In Numbers 9, about dead person making you unclean. And then it often gets tied into kind of desires and heart. And I think some scholars think it more seems to kind of hang out in that area. So like Jeremiah 2, where it talks about kind of the lust of a donkey and its appetite and desire. That is nephesh. Then you have the ruach, the other word for spirit. So anything that has the spirit or the breath of life in it, in the flood, Genesis 6, is put to death. But then later on, it gets used in a way more like soul or spirit that we might be familiar with. So Pharaoh, after his dreams, his ruach, his spirit is troubled. This is what's used of kind of the evil spirits or demons in the Old Testament. And then when you get to the New Testament, those are two words are sort of paralleled by Psyche, or Psyche, where we get that from, is often the word used for Nefesh in the Septuagint, or Pneuma, which we again would know as breath, sorry, or spirit, in the same way that Ruach is in the Old Testament. And Jesus has a Psyche. He also has a pneuma. His pneuma is what he gives up on the cross to his Father, surrenders his spirit into his hands. So that's a kind of survey of what these things are and how they all fit together, whether they amount to what we talk about with the soul now is I guess what we're going to bat around. But that is the kind of biblical lay of the land, the Nefesh, the Ruach, the Psyche or Psyche, and the pneuma. Everybody mm-hmm. seems to have them.
Yeah.
Animals seem to have them. At different points, God seems to have some of them. When we get
right, the spirit, right? Yeah. Jesus sort of puns on this in John 3, right? Mm-hmm. The wind or the spirit blows where he wills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the Holy Spirit, you know, is sort of integrated into this system.
Yeah,
Nefesh works, you know, hand in glove with the Latin term spiritus. It means spirit, the way we currently think of the word, but also mm-hmm. breath and wind. And yep. so it's got a more holistic way of operating. And Owen Barfield, I don't know if folks have ever read it, but I would highly encourage the history, I've got it on my shelf right here, History in English Words. Fantastic, fantastic book, which deals with some of the questions about why it is that language seems to have this unified feature as you go farther back in history, and then it kind of diverges later on, and what it would mean, how thinking etymologically really helps us understand the world and as well as history.
That's great, Reese. I think one question, one way of perhaps helping us get at this question of whether the biblical witness is speaking to the sorts of questions that later Christian theology is asking, metaphysically speaking, is to think about the immortality of the soul, right? I mean, so not for Aristotle, which we'll see, but for Neo-Aristotelians later in the Christian tradition, for Neoplatonists, the soul is that which persists after death. I mean, it's a lot of other things, but it is incorruptible. And yet the biblical data on that is a little bit less clear than one might expect, given how insistent the later Christian tradition and even the New Testament seems to be on this point. So I was just wondering if you could speak to the question of immortality a little bit. How should we think about what the Bible has to say about the persistence of the soul after death? One place to start looking might be somewhere like, you know, Psalm 3. Did I mean Psalm 6? Did I mean Psalm 6? Oh, yeah, I did mean Psalm 6. I don't know how I got 3 into my head. Anyhow, yeah, so Psalm 6, 5, you know, the psalmist can say in verse 4 and 5, "Return, O Lord, deliver my soul. O save me for thy mercy's sake. For in death there is no remembrance of me. In the grave, who shall give thee thanks?" Right? So it seems like there's this kind of sort of existence for the soul in the grave, mm-hmm. but it's a kind of less concrete existence than we might think, sort of like, you know, in Homeric Greek, right, where the soul becomes this shadow thing that flits about and becomes more or less real depending on, you know, how it's remembered and whether, you know, that, I mean, obviously the Bible isn't saying all of that, but it does seem to have this kind of like less real
they lack existence. Blood, you know, and that's
right. Right. You have to pour out the blood and then they
you have
become
to,
more
you have to
real.
Build, dig a trench. My favorite passage in the Odyssey, they dig a trench and pour out the blood. They slit the throat of the animal. And then, you know, the spirits crawl up to the trench and soak up the blood with their lips. And then once it touches their lips, they can speak.
Well, I mean, that because that,
Colin,
that
that's kind of disturbing to me.
It feels very real. I mean, I think that's true, you know.
But that accords with, like I said, biblical ways of talking about it in the Old Testament, that, you know, in the life is in the blood, the nefesh is in the blood. And that's just, one of my thoughts on the soul is that it's a kind of common sense instinct. Like, we can bat around and we will in fine and onerous detail what it is, but kind of people sort of know what you mean by it, even if we're going to kind of split the hairs on exactly what it is.
We got to drink the Lord's blood, man, if we want to get eternal life.
Life is in the blood.
Right. The medicine of immortality, as St. Ignatius of Antioch says.
Every time I come to the table, man, I feel like a spirit who's dragging itself across hell. And just, you know, I
to become solid again.
The true word until I get my lips to touch the blood.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, Reese. I mean, it's not obvious to me that people, you know, for example, you know, I took an intro philosophy class in college. I mean, I took, you know, I
what college was that, Reese?
Onsi.
Oh, sorry,
fellow co-host number one.
No, so, but you know, I took an intro to philosophy class, and like, you know, day one, the professor, you know, she studies Aristotle for her, that's her specialty, and she said, you know, like, there's all this debate about whether the soul exists. She said, there's all this debate about whether the soul exists, but like, obviously the soul exists because all we mean by soul is that it's the principle of life, right? So you can be a materialist and believe in the soul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not entirely sure that, I mean, according to one way of speaking, she's obviously right. I'm not sure that I would completely go that far with her, but the students in the class were like really surprised. They're like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's what you mean by the soul. I thought mm-hmm. the soul was this like floaty spirit thing that kind of, you know, moves around in your body and like makes you do stuff. I don't know. So what do you, I mean, do you really think it's that common sense, I guess is what I'm asking?
I think so. Again, just because I think you can plunk yourself down in most societies or history and there'll be some sense that there's this part of us that will go off somewhere and is in some degree separate from our body. But like you say, in the Old Testament, it's a bit cloudy, and the grave, the pit, that you quoted from Sheol, is this kind of dark and shadowy place where it's not clear that all the faithful saints are kind of sitting on a cloud enjoying themselves happily, or that they go off to some, you know, very clear place after they die. But I think it's an area I would put under progressive revelation, that the nature of the curse and death in the world is such that the full extent of it and how it affects the soul and life after death isn't even clear in the Old Testament, but by Christians would say descending to the dead, some would say descending to hell and harrowing hell, and Jesus gives up his spirit. He kind of illuminates just what the sorry state of the soul after death is, as he rescues it and makes it possible for you know, us before Christ comes, if we die, to be together with him in paradise. Yeah, so it's something Jesus illuminates, you know, one of those things that is a room furnished but dimly lit in the Old Testament and lit up in the New. B.B. Warfield said that about the Trinity, but it applies pretty well, I think, to the soul and its immortality.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. So we have this kind of progressive revelation about the nature, the that-ness of the soul, you might say. The fact that the soul exists, that it persists after death, that for Christians it is united to Christ, you know, now and then also after death. But I mean, one way of putting the question, I think, to you, Colin, would be to say, okay, so the Bible gives us the that of the soul, but does it give us much about the what of the soul, or does that sort of happen as Christianity moves out into the empire and begins engaging with other traditions?
Yeah, when I think about this question, the first thing that comes to mind is that the people who were called to be apostles by Jesus were not philosophers. In one sense, they are philosophers, because anyone who's reflective about life and ultimate things is a philosopher. But they weren't, you know, doing that. They weren't people of leisure, to use Aristotle's term, before they're called, right? These are, you know, tax collectors and fishermen and you know, revolutionary activists and things like that. So when they begin studying under Christ and then take on their mission, you see them encountering people who are from a very different social and economic position that they're in, and political position, right? I mean, the Jews are an oppressed people who are living under the Roman Empire. And then they start engaging with Roman citizens who are perfectly comfortable in the Roman Empire and, you know, living off the fat of the land, often, you know, whether it's exploitative or not, it's not pertinent to this question. And so they start engaging with people who are highly educated and who spend their days philosophizing, right? The men of leisure that Aristotle would write about, that is the goal of civilization from their perspective. When that happens, the question comes up, like even in your account of and your summary of what Rhys was saying, that there's this progressive revelation and there's the that-ness or a whatness. There's a beingness of the soul which seems apparent, and then we kind of add more and more. The question that I think the early Christians are probably wrestling with is, well, gosh, it seems as if those who have spent their days in leisure thinking through the problem of the meaning of human existence have gotten farther down this road than the average farmer or fisherman or revolutionary activist who just kind of is aware that there's a soul, right? And mm-hmm. who is kind of waiting for God's revelation. Like, the question in my mind becomes, how far can natural philosophy, right? And it just, as I put it to my students, you know, if I take a chair and I sit in the woods and I think hard enough, how far can I get? And when I look, for example, at Aristotle, it seems as if I can get pretty far. There's not only a sense that we have a soul, but that we share that with other living things, and that there's distinctions which are intelligible to humans about the distinction between those types of things, right? Being animals, souls, vegetative souls, animal souls, and human souls. Mm-hmm. And that of those three, the human soul is distinct in its own horror at its sense of its death. And it is in touch with something immortal and desires this immortality. And all of those things, I think, set the human soul apart. And Aristotle shows that there are folks who are in touch with this. And then I think at that point, the Christian tradition has to wrestle with that. They have to wrestle with the problem of, well, I mean, really, so I would rephrase what you're saying to say, what I think is happening in early Christianity, and I'm not an expert on this stuff at all, but in my reading, what I see happening is an engagement between the early Christian and Judaic mind and way of looking at the world and scripture, engaging with a bunch of folks who have thought really hard about natural philosophy, right? What's going on in reality. And both of those groups are committed to truth and committed to finding out the nature of reality. Both of those groups believe in at least the possibility of revelation by the divine things. Both of those groups believe in God and trying to see, do these things fit together? And if so, where? And so there's certainly ways of interpreting Aristotle, which Christianity says, well, we can't go, we're just not going that way.
Right, like when Aristotle denies the immortality of the soul. Sorry.
I wouldn't say that he does deny the immortality of the soul, but if he were, right, so if there's a way, here's how
I mean, it's possible way of interpreting... that he's materialist about the soul, which Thomas and like the neo-Aristotelian Christian tradition obviously departs from him if that's what he's saying, but it's unclear,
precisely right.
Because it's all about, anyway, we can get into this later. I'll let you finish.
Yeah, or are we one, you know, human soul, right? So that's an interpretation that is made by some Aristotelian interpreters that we,
right,
all...
Like Averroes.
Averroes, yeah. So yeah, we all participate in one global human soul or something like that. Okay, so if Aristotle's saying those things, that we can't go that route. But if you read Aristotle really closely and you just avoid the secondary literature, because I think we get clouded with thousands of years of interpretation, what you see is that Aristotle himself seems not settled on it, right? He's getting out at the very edge of what human reason can get us to, and he's realizing, like, okay, these are the possible moves, but he doesn't land the plane there because he can't know.
I don't know. He seems pretty... So here, we can... I've got, I guess, so...
Anzi's just rolled up his sleeves and...
Right. Do I want to roll up my sleeves or do I want to try to facilitate... Maybe before I start citing the Metaphysics book 7 to you, Colin, I just want to get your thoughts on one more thing, you and Rhys. So Reese, the schematics that he laid out, right? You have Nefesh and Ruach in Hebrew, and you have Psuche and Pneuma in Greek. And yet the Christian tradition has generally upheld two principles, a soul and a body. And the scriptures seem to give us three principles, a soul, a spirit, and a body, or at least that's a possible interpretation. And so I was just wondering, you know, I mean, what you guys think of that, you know? So, I mean, someone like, you know, Plato has a kind of tripartite soul, right? There are three sort of, aspects of it or something.
Powers.
Yeah. And, you know, so maybe there's some room in the soul, the way that the Greeks conceptualize the soul, to sort of like posit another kind of power or principle that could account for the biblical language. I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts about how we should try to coordinate those two, or whether that's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, so like to throw in like, you know, a couple of problem texts or texts where you get that. So 1 Thessalonians 5:23,
right.
Paul says, "Now may the God of peace himself sanctify you completely, and may your whole spirit, pneuma, and soul, psuche, and body, soma, be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ." So we might then think, oh, okay, Paul clearly thinks people are made up of three things, spirit, soul, and body. And then that probably is related to, like I said, in the Shema, where you're told to love God with all your heart, soul, and might. But I think some people say it's not so much that these are three parts, separate elements that make up a person, but there's a sort of concentric nature to them, certainly with the Shema. And I love him kind of with your heart and your inmost self, kind of with your soul, and then your might stretching out to kind of the whole of you. Rather than it being three separate things, and it looks different to love God with each of those things. It's as kind of those Hebraic parallelisms do, it's not quite a parallelism, but Hebrew logic works that way, nursing on, building on, glorifying something as it goes out. So I don't think there's a clear schema for a kind of tripartite view of humanity. And I think we use the same terms in different ways, so soul can mean different things. I think you've just got to pick up on how it's being used in any given context to kind of avoid the confusion. And if I learned something from Aristotle from Colin, it's that like there are different kinds of souls, and Colin thinks that plants have souls because Aristotle thinks that plants have souls.
Plants, I don't think it because Aristotle thinks it. I think it because I've thought
true.
About reality, Reese, and it's
no,
true.
No.
Plants do have souls.
Yeah. I mean, plants obviously have a principle of life. So if all you mean by soul is principle of life, then that's perfectly fine. But so now I guess, you know, one way of proceeding, Colin and I have been building up to this on Twitter and elsewhere, but you know,
in the schoolyard,
right? This, before we came to blows, we were having a conversation. No. But you know, I'm a fan of Descartes. You know, I'm a Cartesian in certain respects, not in others. But I really like needling people who follow Neo-Aristotelianism or Neo-Thomism. And I take Colin to be sort of broadly in that tradition, so I like needling Colin a lot.
I do not. I am a student of Aristotle.
Well, that's even worse, because Aristotle is worse than Thomas on the soul. But anyway, but I just wanted to start maybe talking about like different kinds of conceptions of the soul that Christianity has taken up over time. And I mean, obviously, so you have like the Platonic, you have the Aristotelian, and
same,
the Aristotelian is dominant. And what?
Same thing.
They're not the same thing. They're clearly not the same thing. But, I mean, Aristotle thinks that he's, like, a student of Plato, but, like, actually he's, like, the student who ruins the master's teach. Anyway, doesn't matter. Okay.
He's the Melanchthon, is he, to the Luther?
No, Melanchthon's great. Melanchthon, like, sort
that,
of...
No, that's right, Reese.
No, it's not right. Melanchthon sort of schematizes and like, you know, fills out and shaves off the edges from Luther, but Aristotle just sort of, like, bastardizes Plato. Anyway, we can start talking about like what these different conceptions actually are. So we've talked about the thatness of the soul in the scriptures, we might spend a few minutes talking about the whatness of the soul according to philosophy and sort of Christian theologically, you know, inflected metaphysics. But I wanted to open it just by reading a couple of selections from Metaphysics Book 7. Because one of the key thing for Aristotle is that the soul is the form of the body, right? And so for Plato, the forms have existence of themselves, and then material things participate in forms, which is what makes the material things what they are, right? So a tree is a tree because it participates in the form of treeness, and the form of the tree can exist apart from any actual trees, right? So for Aristotle, he sort of ruins this and says that the form forms actual matter and doesn't have an existence apart from its existence in concrete material instantiations. So the tree has a form, but the form of the tree doesn't exist apart from actual trees. And we learn the form of the tree by abstracting the form from the matter. So then what Aristotle says is that, do you agree with my gloss?
Pretty good.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. So for Aristotle, the soul is the form of the body. And in Metaphysics Book 7, here's what he says about this. So I'm in Book 7, Section 11. So he says, he's asking the question, what sort of parts belong to the form and what sort don't belong to the form but to the concrete thing? So he says, yet if this is not plain, it is not possible to define anything, for definition is the universal and of the form. Okay, so the definition that we give of anything has to be in terms of its form. So he gives the example of like a circle where the form is clearly differentiated from the matter, right? So if you have like a ring, you see a ring in the world, you can clearly, you know, disentangle the shape of the ring, the form of it, the circle, from the ring itself. But he says with humans, it's a little bit more complicated. So he says the form of man is always found in flesh and bones and parts of this kind. Are these then also parts of the form and the formula? No, they are matter. So it seems like he's saying the flesh and the bones aren't part of the form, but they're formed by it. But then he says, but because man is not found also in other matters, we are unable to effect the severance. So for Aristotle, you can't actually, in the case of humans, disentangle the form, that is the soul, from the body, right? Because we only ever see the form instantiated in these sorts of bodies. Whereas like with circles, we see a circle, you know, you can have one made out of wood, you can have one made out of bronze. Why is this important, though? It's important because it implies that there's a kind of inseparability of the form from the matter that would tell against something like the immortality of the soul by implication, right? So for Aristotle, when a person dies, the form goes away. The soul just sort of ceases to exist. And in fact, for Aristotle, you can't even call a body after it dies because it has no form. It's just sort of matter.
A corpse.
So anyway, sorry?
I mean, it's the same word, corpus, but we'd say the difference between a body and a corpse. A corpse is, in the way we think about it, slightly different to a body.
Right. And the body doesn't have the form of a human. Right. It's no longer a human body.
And you would agree with that, right? Body. Corpse is no longer human.
It's no longer a living human, but it does seem to me that we want to say things like, and this is where I'm sort of inconsistent in my own thinking here, but, you know, we want to be able to point to a corpse and say, like, yeah, that was him or her, right? So there is this sense in which whereas Aristotle would be like, you can't, not only can you not say that's him or her, you can't say that's human. There's nothing human about that body.
Well, but even what you wanted to say, you can say that was him or her.
No, I want to say present, right? That's him. Like you see someone dead, like that's him. I mean, we talk this way all the time.
Why do you look for the living among the dead, Anzi?
See, so Colin is a scholastic. You just take a chunk of text. He's a late medieval scholastic. You take a verse, interpret it wildly out of context, and then throw it as a proof text against someone.
That's what we all do.
Yeah. No, but I'm curious, Colin. Do you have a I mean, I wasn't trying to play gotcha there, but
no, no.
I think that's kind of helpful as a way of thinking through the. Well, I mean, I did get you, but I wasn't playing gotcha.
I actually love. I love this passage. It's not where I would go if I was trying to think through the soul. But maybe if I was a Cartesian and I didn't want to look directly at the soul because that would disturb me, I would just look at metaphysics and say, well, but you know, what would metaphysics say? I read this and I think, yes, the human is distinct from all other things in that the study of the external form of the human cannot tell you everything that you can know about the human because you are a human. So there has to be, just as there's an abstraction away from all the various circle things to learn the form of circularity, you have to have an abstraction away from the humans, which of course requires you to abstract from yourself.
Right, but isn't the point of this section of metaphysics that Aristotle says that's not possible? You actually can't, in the case of humans, perform that sort of abstraction because we never see the human instantiated apart from this matter.
That's right. You can never know a human the way you can know circles. But the key distinction that you can learn as a human is that you can know the form of circles, but circles can never know the form of you. And that tells you something.
Okay. No, I get that. I guess I'm just not sure. Really, what I was hoping for was this, like, you know, rescue Aristotle from the implication that the soul isn't immortal, is what I was hoping for.
Oh, well, I'll get there. But
okay.
Yeah. So, but the first step is to say, okay, so what do you learn then about the form of humans? Is that the form of human is the form that can contain all forms in potentiality. So potentially,
right,
you can know anything. Because you contain these forms. Your mind and your ability to conceive of these forms is your ability to possess these forms. Your ability to internalize the forms of the reality outside of yourself. And so, okay, so what is a human? The human is the soul is the form of the body. And so then what's the form of the human body? It's not just the external body, the way that a fox is the form of the fox. It's the form that contains all forms. And, you know, if when you go to De Anima, he then talks about this and he's like, okay, so this is the form of the rational animal, right? We are able to conceive of reality rationally. We're able to hold the forms of reality internal to our minds. And when we are doing that, he says in on the soul in De Anima, we are connected to that which is most, that which is immortal within us, that which is best within us, which is immortal. And so there is an immortality to the human soul as it reaches out to know, which is the key distinguishing feature of the human.
Yeah, no, okay. Okay. I'm not sure if I buy that, but I think that's helpful. And I think your point about, you know, the sort of the human form in potentia containing all other forms that it sort of learns by abstraction. I mean, I think that's fair. So there's another concern that I have though about the Aristotelian conception of the soul. And that is this, right? That the form informs matter for Aristotle, right? That's it. Matter exists spatially, and the form is that which forms matter, right? So it is that which shapes matter, and this sort of implies that there's a spatial dimension to the form, right? That as the sort of form of the object changes, the soul will change. Right. So the medievals had this problem where, you know, it was proposed like, okay, so say, you know, if we want to say the soul is the form of the body, what happens when you lose a hand? Right? the form of the body has changed. Does that mean the soul has changed? And what the medievals had to do to sort of escape this was they developed the idea called helenmerism. And this is coined by the Cambridge Platonist Henry Moore. But the idea of helenmerism is that, well, the soul exists in its entirety, in all of its parts, right? So the soul exists in its entirety in all of its parts. That means that if you have a part of the soul, or the soul is located somewhere in the body, spatially, because that's how they think about this, right? It has a kind of quasi-spatial existence. Then the entirety of the soul is in that part. So if you lose your hand, it's no big deal, because the entirety of your soul is in all the other parts of your body that sort of didn't lose your hand. I mean, Hellenism seems to me kind of self-evidently absurd, right? Like, we just have no reason to believe that anything exists in the world in this manner. And yet, if you deny Hellenism, but you keep Aristotle, then it seems like every time there's a physical change in the body, in the form of the body, you have this sort of change in the soul. What do you say to that?
I mean, there's so many things I could say, and we have only so much time on the podcast. So here's what I will say. Here's what I'll say. There are certainly changes to the body which are transformations of the form of the body, which is the soul. And I would like to ask a Cartesian, if only I knew one, who was worth asking. lo and behold, I have one here. You know, think about somebody who is just like a drunk driver who gets in an accident because they're a jackass. We're gonna have to bleep that. Let me retake it.
Think about
someone who's a drunk driver who gets in an accident because they're an idiot and loses an arm, you know, just for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. In the resurrection, this is not a persistent change of their form, because they are not the form of their body in its ultimate expression. God is the one who possesses the knowledge of the form of their body in its ultimate expression. In the resurrection, they get that arm back. That's the good news. However, take someone who stands up for their faith in the face of someone who's persecuting them. And I mean genuine persecution, as has happened and happens in the church. Someone mm-hmm. who's asked, you know, confess, you know, that you don't believe in, that Jesus is not the Lord, or we're going to chop your arm off.
Right. Our listeners won't be able to see this, but I actually have an icon of the Coptic, the 21
yeah.
Coptic Libyan martyrs in my office. Yeah.
Right. So think about someone, and then they say, well, no, I'm not going to deny that Jesus is the Lord, because Jesus is God and he can save you too. And then they chop the guy's arm off. Okay. Well, in the resurrection, you know, this is a change, because the loss of that arm is connected to the highest possible expression of this person's being, which is obedience to Christ. And keeping that badge as a badge of honor is going to persist in the resurrected body.
Mm-hmm. Do you base that on okay. Jesus still having his scars in
Absolutely.
His resurrection body? Okay.
Yeah. I'm not.
But also, I also think you can get there, you know, at least partially Aristotelianly, because you're thinking about the soul as the form of the body, and that ultimately what we're striving for as beings, or you have to give a teleological account of humanity, is to fully know ourselves and be ourselves. And that's really who these people are. Whereas when you're making some dumb decision that, you know, damages yourself, that's not really who you are. That's why in the resurrection, you don't come back as an old man, because all of these effects of sin aren't real in an ultimate sense. They really have to
okay,
be paid
well,
for
well,
for reality
so,
to be
so the resurrection. But the resurrection body is not a sphere. We're agreeing.
No, you're not a sphere.
We're clear on that,
you're not a
right?
Sphere. Okay. And you're also not an old man. Or if you're an infant, you're not an infant. Right? You come back around, you know, prime of life, as humans are intended to be.
Well, I'm not entirely satisfied with that account. In part, I have some methodological quibbles of sort of appealing to special revelation to sort out what should be settled philosophically.
I'm gonna pray for you.
I think that's helpful. And I guess this broader conversation, I think, you know, specifics aside, because I know we're getting into the weeds here, but I do think it's helpful to sort of highlight how, you know, a lot of times you have these narratives about Christianity where it's like, well, you have this sort of like pure biblical Hebraic teaching, mm-hmm. and then it's sort of like becomes corrupted by Greek philosophy and metaphysical speculation, et cetera, et cetera. But like, you know, Thomas Aquinas is very insistent that if Aristotle is saying the soul isn't immortal. He's wrong. And he develops metaphysical tools, and develops philosophical arguments to combat Aristotle, to defend the truths that we know by revelation, right? So there's also this other, it's not just that like Christianity becomes Hellenized. Christianity Christianizes the Hellenistic world, right? There's this kind of mutual receptivity. So that's, I think, one broader principle to make. As far as Descartes, I'd be happy to defend Descartes, but I don't know, you know, how much of that we want to get into. I will just say that I think one thing that is not sufficiently respected by people who dump on Descartes is that Descartes' conception of spatial existence for immaterial realities has thoroughly won. Like, people don't realize the extent to which the medievals, like, thought of the soul, or even thought of God, according to the divine essence. I mean, Suarez says that God is present spatially according to his essence, right? There's this, he's present throughout creation according to his essence. And Descartes says, no, the mind and God are present everywhere according to their power, but not according to their essence. And then he says, with God, you can't separate power and essence because God is perfectly simple, so it's better not to talk about God when we're having these sort of metaphysical conversations. But I do think it's important to realize that, like, when most of us think of the soul, we don't think of something extending throughout our body, right? Of having the same kind of spatial existence, three-dimensional extensiveness as our body. And that's Descartes. I mean,
I will agree with you polemic. That Descartes has won, but the question is why, and is he right? You know, winning is, as any philosopher knows, is not necessarily a sign of being correct, right? Having convinced the hoi polloi, convincing the hoi polloi is easy.
The hoi polloi are very interested in Cartesian philosophy. This would be wonderful news if it were true, but
they are. Well,
the masses are much more interested in Marvel than Descartes.
Well, but you know, Descartes in his method says, why should we do this? I think this is in the fifth chapter. We should do this because, you know, we can live as long as possible if we follow this sure, certain knowledge that I'm going to offer you through this method. So I think there's, you know, you kind of go to Descartes, you personally go to Descartes for reasons that the masses would not recognize, because you're kind of a nerd and you've read all this neo-scholastic stuff and you don't like it. And there's kind of problems with some medieval person's account of, you know, what happens when your finger gets caught in a, you know, mouse trap or something.
Yeah, I mean, Occam thinks that, like, if your finger gets cut off, like, your identity changes. I mean, that's sort of like a logical, anyway, not that you're an Occamist, but, like,
yeah,
that's true.
But that doesn't sound insane to me, you know, when Descartes...
I want to get this on the record. Colin is actually an alchemist, ladies and gentlemen.
Sound the Occam Jackson.
Right.
So, you know, people go to Descartes and his method because he unhooks human knowledge from ultimate ends in a way which gives rise to modernity.
No, that I'll just kind of stop you there. That is absolutely not correct.
But that's not. I mean, what I want to ask you, which is more pertinent to, I mean, you would agree, Descartes has given us the modern world. Confreres.
I think modernity is a sort of suspect category.
All right.
This is actually important. This is actually just give me 1 second, then you can ask my question. I know, you're rolling your eyes, but here's what I want to say. A lot of times in Christian critiques of early modern philosophy, like Descartes, like Hume, who I also really like. Hume is, like, totally wrong about everything, but he's delightful and wonderful, and everyone should read him. But they sort of, like, play this game where they sort of, like, lump everything together. It's like Descartes and his friends. And his friends are, like, Hume and Hobbes and, like, the Cambridge Platonists and, like, just everyone who's doing something new. But, like, Descartes is different, like, completely different than someone like Hume, or he's completely different.
And unlike most of those polemicists, I have read all of these people, and my considered opinion is that they are actually doing something which is connected, all of them. And the connection is that you can find evidence, very clearly stated by each of them, that the point of their knowing, the point of their philosophy, is the expansion of the human capacity to do.
I think that's a sort of truncated reading of Descartes. Descartes also thinks, you know, so
I don't
for
think
example,
that's the only
his,
thing he's doing.
In his,
I don't think,
in his introduction to in his introduction to the Meditations, you know, his letter to the University of Paris, the faculty of Paris, you know, he thinks that philosophy has a number of tasks, but among them are, you know, the defense of the immortality of the soul and the existence of God. And he thinks in his Meditations that the purpose of philosophy, that philosophy terminates in the contemplation of God, right? So he says that in, you know, Meditation 3. So I would just like to, anyway, for the record, I think that's a sort of one-sided account of Descartes' project. But anyway, you were going to ask
Here's the question I have for you about Descartes. How do you make sense as a Cartesian of the resurrection?
So Descartes, I think I make sense of it more easily than I think an Aristotelian would for the following reason. So Descartes, you know, famously says that the human being is a material, or is an immaterial mind, right? That most of like I am an immaterial mind. And yet Descartes also says in, I think, the sixth meditation, maybe it's the fifth, that the mind forms such a union with the body that the two are one. So you know, a lot of people think that Descartes has this sort of view of the mind where it's like completely disconnected from the body, or like moves the body around like a puppeteer moving a puppet. And that's just not true. I mean, Descartes obviously knows that you know, our senses can impact our minds, right? He knows that our mental states and mental phenomena are that the sort of interaction goes both ways, and he says that they're a union. So I think a lot of the problems, you know, the sort of mind-body dualism attributed to Descartes, I mean, and Jean-Luc Marion actually has just written a book on this, which I'm excited to see. I have it on my shelf. I haven't read it. But, you know, a lot of the people who attribute this kind of hard mind-body dualism to Descartes don't take him seriously enough when he asserts the fundamental union of the mind and the body. And yet, for Descartes, the mind is also simple, probably. It's unclear if he thinks the intellect and will are distinct faculties, in which case it wouldn't be simple. But the mind is incorruptible. Whereas for Aristotle, it's not clear that the soul, the form of the body, is you know, incorruptible. It seems able to change and to cease to be. But for Descartes, it is incorruptible. It doesn't change. It doesn't cease to be. And so when the body dies, the soul, you know, continues to live. Hopefully, you know.
I see. So the attraction for you is the strong stance on the immortality of the human soul. That's
an attraction to me. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a number of. I also don't think I think you know, I don't want. It doesn't make sense to me to think that souls exist in space in quite the same way that bodies do. So that's another attraction, right? Descartes gives an account of the mind, whereby. It's present to material reality by its power, but isn't extended in space like material objects.
So why is it that all these philosophers who follow Descartes, when they start doing experiments on the human brain, you know, start losing their minds? They start sort of, like, for example, there's these cases where, like, a guy had a screw kind of accidentally shoot up through his head and it damaged part of his brain. And his character changes completely. He's a completely different person, you know, and if... Occam, though I'm not an alchemist, you know, you chop the guy's finger off and he's different in some way without the finger. It seems like they have an account of, like, oh yeah, if you shoot a screw through a guy's brain, you know, frontal cortex, he's going to be a different person on the other side of that.
Well, sure. I
Whereas
mean, but
Cartesians,
they, no,
go ahead.
I mean, people knew about brain damage, right? I mean, it's not like brain damage is like a new discovery. Like, Descartes knew that, like, someone gets hit on the head the wrong way, then their actions change and they become sort of different.
But it really does. I mean, these cases really do produce a revolution in the philosophy of the mind of the person from people who are followers of Descartes in the 1900s.
Right. But I mean, Descartes has a theory of mind-body interaction, as I was saying before, that can account for why specifically Because for Descartes, the mind and the body interact, right? But they interact in the brain, right? This is sort of like where Descartes thinks the interaction occurs primarily. So rather than the mind being sort of present to the entirety of the body according to its power, it's present to the brain in particular. And he actually thinks it's like the pineal gland or something. I mean, you know, I don't know about that, right? I mean, obviously I'm not going to follow his sort of neuroscience, but he has a sort of, it's not that the mind is disconnected from the body such that you can explain the human person as they exist in the world in terms of only one or the other, right? This is my point about the union. And I think that, you know, I mean, maybe 19th, I'm not really super familiar with 19th century Cartesianism, so I can't really speak to what they're doing. But I do think that there is an account that can be given for Descartes' philosophy that of course doesn't fly in the face of very obvious findings of
I think he's reaching for this clear and distinct knowledge, right? Clear, certain, distinct knowledge.
Yeah, clear and distinct. That's his and, sort of like criteria
over and
certainty.
Over again. So he wants that. That's all knowledge to him. And as an Aristotelian, I would say there are different kinds of knowledge, and there are some things about which you can't have that kind of knowledge.
Oh, he agrees, though. He doesn't think that you can have sort of clear and distinct.
But he does think you can get it about the immortality of the human soul.
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
He thinks
I think that
metaphysics, that all metaphysics is sort of within the purview of reason. Since the soul.
So I think we're going to disagree there, but we might. That might be the place where we. Let's just cut it there. That's it.
Anyway, I don't. Sorry,
this that was good. That was wonderful. Just charming person, Anzi. I like talking to you.
Oh, thank
my
you.
My favorite Cartesian.
Like Hume, you're confidence. Wrong about everything.
You know what, though? I would rather be... No, I wouldn't.
I'd rather be wrong with Hume.
Wrong about everything. I'd rather be wrong with Descartes than right with Aristotle. And the good thing is that since ultimately our metaphysical speculations don't impact, I think, our salvific status, I should be okay, even if I'm a Cartesian. If God can save even a rich man, he can save a Cartesian.
If God can save me, he can save a Cartesian.
Right. So anyway, I think that was a fun conversation. Hopefully we didn't lose our listeners, you know, too much in the weeds. Things got pretty technical there for a little bit. As I said, I think the main takeaway that is worth getting from this conversation is that there isn't a sort of unidirectional relationship between Christianity and philosophy, right? These things are always interacting. Thomas is changing Aristotle to fit with what we know about the truths of divine revelation. And Descartes, likewise, is actually, you know, very careful not to sort of trespass onto theology's territory as he sees it. You know, he'll say in his letters to his friends, like, I don't want to go there because those are truths of faith, and they should remain inviolable and sort of apart from my speculation. So I think maybe that can be a takeaway for our listeners who don't care about whether the soul is like a snub nose according to Aristotle and the metaphysics.
Reese, I want to know if you can, you know, take us back to scripture now that we've got lost ourselves in the murky cesspools of philosophy. You know, what do you think as a reader of scripture, having heard this stuff?
Well, I think that the distinction of different kinds of soul and the fact that the word is used to refer to different things is for me helpful in realizing how you can hold together that earthy kind of hippie Hebraic way of thinking about the soul and this Hellenized, more abstract philosophical way of thinking about it. That, like you said, it's when Christianity comes into contact with philosophy that it's not that they realize people necessarily think something contradictory to them, but they were thinking about areas of reality that they and scripture, for whatever reason, hasn't devoted that much attention to. It does not mean those things aren't real. It just means that that's not an area of reality that the Bible has especially weighed in on. listening to you two give your accounts, I sat back there and just watched these guys duke it out, which I've been waiting to do for a while. If one of the contentions...
Reese has been agitating for this.
Yeah, well, but if one of the contentions there is whether we can know by reason something like the immortality of the soul, just to tie us back to the progressive revelation, apparently, of the kind of status and nature of the soul in Scripture, it does seem like you need the progressive special revelation of Scripture to give a full picture of the nature of the soul. So I wonder if that's a point in Aristotle's favour, that our natural reasoning can only get us so far, and we need clarity to be given to us from outside on the kind of the exact nature and status of the soul. So adjudicating between these two positions, I'm going to give a points victory to Colin and Aristotle.
Well, I would just like
to conclude this overlong discussion.
Thomas actually thinks that there are good philosophical reasons to believe in the immortality of the soul. He doesn't just sort of pull a Colin, you know, revelation juke.
His opinion is noted.
That's not what I said.
He makes arguments.
His opinion is noted.
And those arguments are the arguments you can see in Aristotle and Plato and
they're
in other
not,
places.
So, anyway, but, doesn't because Thomas thinks that the soul is a subsistent that can exist apart from the body. Anyway, we should start talking about what we're reading these days. So, Colin, since I was a little bit ungentlemanly to you there at the end, I would like to give you the first shot at talking about what we're reading.
Well, I am reading, I have been reading to prepare for this conversation, which is long overdue, with my good friend Ansi Camel, Body Self-Dualism in Contemporary Ethics and Politics by Patrick Lee and Robert P. George.
Oh, nice.
Not my favorite thinkers on the subject, but the fantastic book in particular, if you find yourself to be a student of Aristotle who has to have an extensive conversation with a Cartesian, and are a Christian who's hoping that, you know, you can defend the faith. They do a good job of laying out several of the various problems and positions, that you get into in modern philosophy, and I think ultimately make a really compelling case for, why the more of a Thomistic position, you know, the Robert P. George being the new natural law, you know, champion, why that mm-hmm. position is ultimately where you'd want to land.
Yeah. 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 Well,
I don't agree with everything in it, but it's worth a read for this conversation in particular.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Reese, what are you up to?
Far, far away from all of this metaphysical navel gazing. I ordered a new copy of, George Herbert's The Temple, because I realized I'd lost mine. We're recording this just after Easter, but I got this a while ago, a couple of weeks ago, during Lent, and we started off talking about Lent. And the first poem I opened to, totally randomly, was his poem, Lent. And I succeeded at Lent. I gave up drinking, and was very glad to get to Easter weekend. Every Friday night during Lent, I'd kind of, you know, stump up to my wife and be like, I really want to drink. It's Friday night. This is part of my routine. And she was like, don't do it. You'll regret it. Have some self-control. You're a grown man. I opened up to this poem out of nowhere, kind of in the middle of one of those weekends. And it says, welcome, dear Feast of Lent. Who loves not thee? He loves not temperance or authority, but is composed of passion. Oh, great. That's me. Pinned to the wall right there.
That's good.
That hung over me and got me through to Easter weekend. And actually, that whole poem, it probably kind of summarizes basically everything we said about Lent and why it's a good idea. So go and read George Herbert and The Temple.
Reese, do you, for our American listeners, you know, I'm sure we all have an image of you kind of walking down through foggy old England to your local pub. Is that pretty accurate? Is that how you live your life?
Well, the pubs are closed right now. they'll be open probably by the time you hear this, outside at least. Yes, though the pub is not, the local pubs here, which have been variously owned by various members of my family at different points, actually, are not full of kind of wistful inklings. They're full of sort of intimidating men who smell of fag smoke and kind of have green faded tattoos and kind of, you know, talk about how much they love Brexit, which is fine. You know, that's my family essentially. But you know, it's not they're not sat around kind of smoking pipes and talking about God the King and Prince George. Yeah.
Well, very good. That's kind of depressing to know that all of our fantasies are false. You know, I mean,
yeah, and I don't think any of them have ever met an American.
Oh man, I gotta change that.
Yeah. Well, I've been reading Albert the Great's commentary on Dionysius's mystical theology, which has been really, really phenomenal. And actually, Reese, to your point, in Aristotle and Thomas's favor, it's actually not a point in Aristotle and Thomas's favor.
Oh, nice.
It's a point in Albert the Great's favor, because Albert thinks that we need divine illumination even prior to the fall to know the things of God. And Thomas, you know, thinks that our rational capacities are sort of sufficiently sort of healthy and capable prior to the fall that this sort of special divine illumination isn't necessary. But it's been a really interesting read. I have to say I have a bit of a taste for medieval mystical theology. It's really
stuff.
Fascinating stuff. Hmm?
It's great stuff.
Oh yeah, it's really fantastic. I mean, you know, the idea I've been thinking about a lot recently, and this is actually in Luther's Galatians commentary too, is that, you know, the light, the divine light, allows us to see reality, you know, to see even certain divine things, the special illumination from God. And yet God dwells above that in darkness, right? Mm. And so the ascent of the soul to God is an ascent through light into darkness. Because even though God is light, you know, when we look at the sun, we're blinded. And so this is kind of like, and Luther says the same thing that in his Galatians commentary, that we have to ascend above the light of reason into the darkness of faith. Mm-hmm. And so I've just been really like thinking about that.
Darkness due to our position relative to God.
Not as finite, to God. As finite beings.
Yeah.
Isn't that Lewis in the Space Trilogy? Holy places are dark places.
Oh, I don't know. I haven't, because the model that Albert is using, and this is maybe what Lewis is appealing to, is Moses' ascent up the mountain. That's the sort of the image for mystical ascent to God. So,
I just always assume there's nothing I've read that C.S. Lewis hadn't read. That's funny.
Yeah.
Generally a pretty safe assumption.
No, it is. Absolutely. I mean, that guy read everything. Well, we're also going to be spotlighting this week, as we do every week, something from the Davenant Institute happening. And Colin was going to fill us in on a course he's teaching this summer at the Davenant House.
Yeah, I am teaching an in-person course at the Davenant House immediately following our convivium. So it's going to be June 7th through the 11th. I was supposed to be teaching it last year. We had some students signed up, and then the pandemic shut it down. So hoping we can get folks back. It's going to be the philosophy of law and the natural law tradition. And so we will be dealing with Richard Hooker and you know, anyone who's read Lewis's Abolition of Man and wants to know more. This would be it'd be ideal. The two main texts, however, are going to be Plato's Laws and Thomas Aquinas's Treatise on Law, and trying to think through
how
the theories of law, which we see in, you know, Plato and Aristotle, make their way into the Christian tradition, engage with the special revelation of Scripture, and what that all means for the contemporary moment, where most of our legal theorists are positive law theorists who think that law, you know, the laws of the United States, or just whatever we make up, is law. And you know, the older tradition would be very disturbed by this, because law has to somehow be connected to reality. It's not, mm-hmm. we are not the ultimate deciders on these things. So,
No, that's great. I'm excited that you're teaching that course. And we actually, speaking of that, we should have, coming out in June or July, a book, which features an essay on James Wilson, the founding father, who has this like really sort of interesting idiosyncratic, ultimately unconvincing, but like still awesome way of synthesizing democracy and democratic self-governance with natural law. theory. And so
I'll just say one other thing. I think a course like this can be quite intimidating to folks. So if you're a listener and you're like, oh, I'm free, I'd be interested in coming, but I'm, you know, I don't know, you know, hundreds of pages of Plato and Thomas Aquinas, not my thing. Even if the reading seems intimidating, I would encourage you to come. My job at this is to make it explicable to you. So don't let the size of the reading or something be the thing which deters you. If you have any interest, let us know. Send us an email. We exist at the Davenant Institute to help figure out how to get this stuff in a useful way into as many young Christians' minds as possible.
Great. Thanks a lot. If you like metaphysical bickering, and you like the metaphysical bickering that happened on this podcast.
We just lost all of our listeners.
I know. Well, since we've lost them, no one will mind much that I'm asking them to go rate and review us. But no, if you like what we've discussed today, what you hear on this podcast, if you like our conversations, please, you know, rate us, review us on Apple Podcasts. It's very helpful for us. We appreciate the feedback. We've gotten a lot of really positive comments. Including from a Roman Catholic who compared me to who was I compared to? I was compared to.
I believe you're Joe Rogan.
Yeah,
Joe less Rogan, high. Right? But less high, apparently. So
still high,
still high, but
not
less high.
As high,
not as high. It would take a lot of work to get as high as Joe Rogan. but anyway, yeah, please give us a 5-star review. We really appreciate it. If you didn't like what you heard, and you have something constructive, you can email Colin. And if you didn't like what you heard and you don't have something constructive, you can take it to the Lord in prayer. anyway, it's been another good week. It was a pleasure to be here with you guys. We are the editors. This is the Ad Fontes podcast. And we will see you next week.